TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Russ Baker, Family of Secrets. Dan Rather, whose career-ending exposé of George W. Bush's failed National Guard service is described in one of the chapters in Russ Baker's book, said about Family of Secrets, "It made me rethink even those events I witnessed with my own eyes," end quote by Dan Rather. Family of Secrets is not just the story of the Bush dynasty, although Baker delivers many details that are intriguing and never before revealed. Russ Baker describes America's invisible government, the powers behind the scenes, with examples from the CIA, oil and banking, and how these institutions are created by and in return make use of people like the Bush family. Russ Baker is an investigative journalist and has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and served as a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. He is part two of the interview, filmed in Berkeley, California in April 2010.
Trying to reconstruct George H.W. Bush's life and realizing that he had had this secret life in intelligence, I looked at any comments he made about his life in different periods, and I read some memoirs where he talks about different points, and when he gets to 1963, when Kennedy's assassinated, he sort of skips over it. He has maybe a few words that are very innocuous, and then he goes right on, and I thought, well, that's strange. You would normally comment on a cataclysm of that sort, particularly since Kennedy was killed in Texas and Mr. Bush was a Texan involved in politics there. But he just skips it. And then I heard that during an interview, he'd been asked if he recalled where he was the day that Kennedy was shot, and he had claimed that he could not remember. And I just was flabbergasted by this. And I said, well, everybody remembers where they were if they were alive at the time, over the age of, what, 4 or 5. And he was a middle-aged man in Texas in politics, and he said he couldn't remember. And so I thought, I'm going to figure out where he was.
How did you go about it?
I found out that he was a candidate for the U.S. Senate in the fall of 1963. He was in another town in Texas giving a speech at the time. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Why doesn't he just say that? So I began looking at where that town was, what time the speech was, why he was there. And then I started discovering all these other amazing anomalies. Like, for example, a declassified FBI document that is about the assassination. It's from J. Edgar Hoover, and it talks about interagency briefings. And they're talking to someone from the Defense Intelligence Agency and someone from the CIA, and it names them. And it says, briefing included Mr. George Bush of the CIA. Now, this is about November 22, so I thought, now, wait a minute, here's a man who can't remember where he was. In another incarnation, he's a candidate for U.S. Senate giving a speech in this town, Tyler, Texas, which turns out to be just a hop, skip, and a jump from Dallas. Then there's this other document, and according to this document, he's not a candidate at all. He's a CIA officer under very deep cover, being consulted in some context about the assassination. And it mentions Cuban exiles, and it indicates that Mr. Bush somehow is working with Cuban exiles, which, of course, is very interesting because we know there are all those theories about Cuban exiles having had some kind of role in some of these convulsions. So we also know that John F. Kennedy had refused to invade Cuba when the Bay of Pigs invasion failed. We know that he fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. Alan Dulles was a very close friend of the Bush family. He had been with Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm that represented United Fruit and all these other big multinationals that thought it was their prerogative to willy-nilly put in and replace foreign leaders. So you see there was a clash between John Kennedy and all these people. In any case, I then found another declassified FBI memo. Not declassified, I'm sure, with Mr. Bush's concurrence, but these things happen. And this one indicated that on November 22, 1963, at 1:45 p.m., Mr. George H.W. Bush of Houston, Texas, calling from Tyler, Texas, calls the Houston office of the FBI and says, my name is, and I am a private citizen, I'm an oil man. Doesn't mention that he works for the CIA, doesn't mention that he's running for office, and he just says, I heard the president was shot and I may have some information on who shot him.
That's astounding.
Now we've got four different George Bushes. Same man, but four different incarnations.
Who did he finger?
He fingered a man by the name of Parrott in Dallas, Texas, a young fellow who was a volunteer at the Republican headquarters there. And he said, I don't know much about this guy, but I hear he's been talking about, he's a radical right wing and so forth. So I, of course, went off and researched Mr. Parrott, and I have one full chapter of Family of Secrets just about the Parrott phone call and what we can learn about Mr. Parrott. And it was very clear that it was the call was a red herring. Mr. Parrott had nothing to do with it. I think Mr. Bush surely knew that Mr. Parrott had nothing to do with it, particularly when you take in concert all this other information about Mr. Bush. In the end, had to conclude that the phone call to the FBI was basically for the purpose of establishing that he had called to offer information in the investigation to be helpful, and he went out of his way to announce, I'm calling at 1:45 p.m. from Tyler, Texas. Well, what is Tyler, Texas? It's not Dallas, let's put it that way. And that then gets into other things about where he was. One more thing I'll throw out, and then I guess we can move on. But I also discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald had a handler. It was a man who, in the last year of his life, basically directed him. And this is, again, in almost no books. This was a white Russian emigre involved himself with intelligence activities, very well connected into oil companies with millionaires in Houston and Dallas, tremendous well connected, knew LBJ, knew all of these people. And this man, De Morenschild, turns out was an old friend of George H.W. Bush. And so at the time of the assassination, the man who had been basically sort of managing Oswald's life was an old friend of Mr. Bush. And I find correspondence between them, which again is featured in Family of Secrets. And I invite people to read the book and to see for themselves if all of these things could be coincidences.
So fast forward to when Father Bush was head of the CIA, and he's getting these letters from De Morenschild.
That's right.
That he's getting worried.
He's had a few letters in the intervening years, and De Morenschild stays in touch with him. Bush now is the head of the CIA, and he gets a letter. In the letter, Mr. De Morenschild says, Dear George, congratulations on your appointment as the head of the CIA. I'm sure you'll do a fine job. I'm reaching out to you. I'm sorry to bother you, but something very troubling is happening. He said, perhaps I've been indiscreet in saying too much about Lee Harvey Oswald, but I feel that a net is closing in on me. I don't know whether it's FBI or who's involved in this, but if you could please do something to remove the net. I'm an old man now, and I can't be a harm to anyone. And Bush types a letter back to him. First, he types a memo to it for the files in the CIA, and he says, I do know this man. See, he can't say he doesn't know him because somebody will find out it's not true. He's very clever about that. So he says, I do know this man. He was the uncle of my roommate. I really haven't been in much touch with him. And he says, I know his child died, and he's upset. So in his letter, he says, George, I know you're upset because your child died, but I can assure you that I've looked into it, and there's no investigation of you. So, don't worry and relax. And 6 months later, George De Morenschild is dead from a shotgun blast to the head, described as a suicide.
And that was the day before he was to testify?
Well, what was happening was Congress, continuing the work of the Church Committee, had expanded into a special investigation of assassinations, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And just as they were getting going, people who were promoting the idea that there was no organized effort there, that Oswald had acted alone, they wanted to stop this investigation. Someone from the CIA reached out to the Reader's Digest, a magazine, and encouraged the Reader's Digest to do its own new take on the assassination, and they hired a man who was interesting in his own right, and he traveled around the country getting to every witness basically before the committee could get to them. Very interesting in itself, because the Reader's Digest had a long association, very close with the Central Intelligence Agency. So Reader's Digest reporters get out there, interview people, and a Reader's Digest reporter was interviewing George De Morenschild the day that he died, that he died. And that day, a staff member of the House Select Committee on Assassinations arrived to interview George de Morenschild, who was already at a hotel being interviewed by the Reader's Digest man. And de Morenschild came home for lunch, was told that this man from the committee had been there to see him. He appeared not disturbed by that. He said, thank you very much. He took the card. And sometime later, they heard a shotgun blast, and he was dead. Right. So he never was able to testify. Coincidence, I'm sure.
So where are the Bushes now in relationship to the people who pull the strings?
Well, first of all, the Bushes are enablers and facilitators. They're not the top level. This is very important to understand. The top level, you have to look at things like the list of the Fortune 100, the Fortune 500, the Forbes list of the wealthiest people. We've never even heard of most of those folks. Billionaires we've never heard of. And they, not all of them, but many of them retain their wealth and their power and even their senses of themselves by continuing to orchestrate what other people do. And what is more important, of course, than the President of the United States? And so these people are very interested in this. The Bushes are a family that likes being in the limelight. They like the public service lifestyle. They're comfortable. They don't need much more. And so they are the soldiers. But I'll tell you, the Bushes are not going away. First of all, Robert Gates, who's a loyalist to the Bush family, he was the CIA director under H.W. He was a career CIA officer. Then he became the head of the George H.W. Bush Library in Texas, which I can tell you was totally sanitized and cleaned up so that you couldn't find practically anything there.
You were there.
Yeah. It's a scary place. And then he was put on the boards of some powerful companies involved, related to the oil business and so forth. Then George W. Bush comes into the White House, and they bring him back in, and they make him the Secretary of Defense, the final Secretary of Defense. And then Barack Obama comes in with change you can believe in, and he keeps Robert Gates in as Secretary of Defense. And Gates is, he's influential. And so you've got a direct pipeline into the White House for the Bushes at the highest level. You have quite a few of their other people are still there. An article I published recently on our website, whowhatwhy.com, our nonprofit investigative website, about Obama and his relationship with a bank called UBS, a Swiss bank, and about the appointments he makes. And he appointed this Swiss banker, this guy from the American division of a Swiss bank, to as one of his economic advisors. And another person on that same panel is George W. Bush's SEC chairman, Securities and Exchange Commission chairman, an old friend of the Bush family who handled their investments. He's now in the Obama circle. And you see this at all levels. You don't see any radical changes with the intelligence operations, with the Pentagon, and so forth. And again, that's not to judge Obama so much as to say that he just doesn't really matter in this equation. This is what we don't understand, is that presidents don't matter that much, and there's a whole other set of individuals and institutions that do matter that we completely neglect. But to answer your question about the Bushes, they're also very much in the picture. George W. Bush is working on his legacy with this library and this think tank and this democracy center. Karl Rove, his image meister, is out there with a bestseller remaking their whole story. And Jeb Bush, I believe, is running for president. And I believe it's very, very likely that we will see a third Bush in the White House.
I'd like to step back to the National Guard story of Bush, because that was almost broken by Dan Rather, and then it fizzled.
Right.
And it fizzled in a way that it was really set aside and nobody looked at it anymore.
Well, it's not just that it fizzled. You see, because I've spent much of my career studying covert operations and psychological operations, when I see major convulsions of any kind, someone like Dan Rather, highly visible, highly paid, well-known, well-respected icon of journalism, completely removed from the scene, I want to know as much as possible about that. And not only was there this whole thing fizzle, there actually was a chill or a pall cast over all journalistic efforts to look any further into the President of the United States' own military service record. And in Family of Secrets, I go into this extensively. I look into those documents that CBS News put on the air. I look at Rather's own relationship with the Bushes. I look at what I have found out about Bush's military service record. Were those documents representing essentially the truth or not? How did it come to be that they were under attack? What caused Dan Rather to be forced out? And what was the effect on the public debate in the final months of a very close 2004 presidential race? And I can tell you that I had some very big stories and met with major news organizations who know me and my work and were very interested. Ultimately, they were afraid to run them because of what had happened to Dan Rather. They said, it's just too hot a topic. We can't cover it. And I believe that the lack of coverage on those things actually changed the outcome of the 2004 election. I don't think Bush would have been reelected if any of these stories had come out.
So do you believe the documents Dan Rather was given are a fraud?
You know, I did a lot of research on them. In fact, full disclosure, I actually had copies of those documents prior to 60 Minutes putting them on the air, and I was looking at them. And one thing that struck me about them was that they closely mimicked the actual information that I and a few other reporters had been collecting. We knew that what was represented in these documents was essentially true. Whether or not those documents are real, I can't say with any degree of certainty, although I can tell you this, the way in which Rather was attacked almost immediately within seconds of those documents being put on television, the fact that the media was persuaded that these documents were definitely false, and by the way, they're not definitely false. All of these purported claims about the typefaces and so forth, the jury is still out on that. This is a very complex technical issue, and there's been no proper forensic investigation of this whole thing, and so we don't know. But I've increasingly come to the conclusion that those documents were fakes, but unlike the way the media treated it, it wasn't that they were fakes that were created by enemies of Bush, but that the net effect of those documents was to help Bush.
You know, my experience on programs such as this one is that they get a huge response.
Yeah.
But the people who you really expect to take it on are, you know, in some ways your colleagues.
Yes, yes.
You shouldn't be the only one. And they fear that any discussion of behind the scenes is just so disempowering. And I find that extraordinary because I'm fascinated by stories behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I feel very empowered to finally know who's pulling the strings.
Well, you see, this was something interesting to me because in addition to writing for very conventional news outlets and even some ones on the conservative side, and also writing for the liberal and left, sort of opinion media, I was surprised at how unreceptive they were to these kinds of revelations. And as you point out, they're uncomfortable with these meta investigations. They like the idea that life and politics and so on are like a sporting exhibition. There are two teams. You're on one team, you're on the other team. It's up, it's down. At the end of the game, we all shake hands. And this is really keeps people giving them money. It keeps people reading the endless parade of personalities and bills and fights and things like that. But they're not very receptive to this deeper analysis. It is in part, as you say, because they sort of feel it's disempowering. But it's also simply because it's bad for business for them. See, because if things are really this bad, then we need to stop doing what we're doing, and we need to shake everything up, and we need to discuss things in completely different terms. I happen to believe that nothing will change until we really do accept this kind of almost Sartrean nausea about reality, that we need to, or perhaps you say Camusian, this existential notion that things are much more worrisome. It's not that we don't have to take action, it's that we have to take different action. And we have to take action in terms of empowering ourselves first with information. Because the fact of the matter is, I dare say that most people listening to me talk, even if they are well-educated and well-read and everything else, they don't know this stuff. And I didn't know this. And so unless we have good information, we can't begin to do anything. But if we do have good information and we share it, this is the brilliance of the internet. If we share it, we begin step by step to change the world. And interestingly enough, the more I know and the more people I know, the more we feel empowered to actually begin making choices. We don't feel hopeless or helpless or disempowered at all, quite the contrary.
Now, we covered in this interview mostly Republicans, but the workings behind the scenes is not a one-party issue.
Well, it's not at all. I mean, LBJ, to some extent Jimmy Carter, to some extent Bill Clinton. I mean, there are real differences between Democrats and Republicans in this country. I don't think one wants to minimize those differences. But at the same time, there are these continuities. And those continuities are the certain things that may not change. The power of Wall Street may not change. Franklin Roosevelt, shortly after being inaugurated, wrote a letter to Colonel Edward House, who'd been the top advisor to President Wilson. And he said, look, you and I both know that the real power in this country is not in Washington, it's on Wall Street. And he knew it. He knew that he couldn't do whatever he wanted. They all know that. And so the power of money, the power of the military-industrial complex, the essential role of war in keeping our economy going. If we didn't have war, there would be almost no economy to speak of because our manufacturing base disappeared a long time ago. We outsource even services we outsource now with the telemarketing and what have you. And so in these areas, no change is possible. Reining in the national security state, the spy agencies, Truman was concerned about that. Eisenhower was concerned about the military-industrial complex, being a general himself. Kennedy took some of these people on, and we see what happened to him. Carter tried to take them on, too. Even Jimmy Carter, who was no great leftist, began trying. He went after the covert operations capacity in the CIA, and they went after him, and they kept him to one term. And as I describe in Family of Secrets, even Jimmy Carter may have been a victim of what was tantamount to a kind of a coup, elements within the government injuring him. And what did they do? They kept him to a single term. He was out.
You know, I wondered in your Nixon story what Nixon would have said reading your book. I mean, did he die being pretty ignorant of what had happened to him?
You know, he's a very complex figure, and I can't quite figure out how much he just didn't know. I think he was a man of secrets. And my book, of course, is called Family of Secrets. And I meant that in a larger sense. I meant that we're in a family of secrets, the American or even world family of secrets. It's a genus. It's a species. It's a family of secrets, and it's all interconnected. And so I think Richard Nixon was a very secretive man, and I think early on, when, let's say, the Bushes and the forces around them, the bankers, basically created him as a politician, he was told, you may never talk about this. You have to be a grassroots guy who is sponsored by small businessmen in your community, which is the story in all the conventional biographies. And so he knew that, and he understood. And he understood, and he saw what happened to John F. Kennedy. And by the way, you know, Richard Nixon, people don't know this, Richard Nixon was in Dallas the morning Kennedy was shot.
Oh, what did he do there?
Well, this is a very interesting thing. I believe that he was brought to Dallas for the purpose of being put on the spot. And he left shortly before the shooting. He was on a plane. I describe this all in Family of Secrets, how mortified he was when he thought, my gosh, they've just killed the man who was my opponent, who beat me for the presidency. He's just been killed. I was there. What are people going to think? And the more you look at that, the more you have to wonder why he was there. I don't think he was part of a plot. I think he was part of an effort to bring him there and to say, there's even a quote, because he says, there but for the grace of God go I. I think there was a message to him. You're on your way. You'll get the White House eventually, but you better be careful. And I think he knew that. And I think that's why he made that joke about putting Spiro Agnew in as his insurance against assassination, that he knew that if you're president of the United States, just as if you're president of any of those other countries, there are people gunning for you, very, very powerful interests. And you have to play ball. You have to keep some secrets. And so he was in a difficult position throughout his career and then in the White House because he had to keep these people happy, but he wanted to keep them at bay, and he wanted to do what he thought he could do to secure his legacy, as all presidents do. And it's a very, very difficult situation to be in. So I think probably he would like the book. Probably he'd find it interesting. Probably he would feel, I would say, almost kind of vindicated in certain ways. I am not making him out, let me be clear, to be a good man. I am not making him out to be a total reformer, but he was a much more complex figure. Many of the things that he instituted as president today are seen as reforms. And if you go and you listen to those tapes at the National Archives, there are thousands of hours of tapes, and we've only heard a few of them, and they were taken out of context. If you listen to some of the other tapes, you see him as a much more involved person discussing policy. And if you read the memoirs of some of his top aides, he was warning them about the oil industry, about the sugar lobby, about big companies, about the right wing in America. I mean, it was much more complicated, much more complicated.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour interview with Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets. Russ Baker is an investigative journalist and has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and Esquire. He has served as a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and is the founder of WhoWhatWhy.com, a nonpartisan, nonprofit investigative news organization. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. There you can find links to the book and Russ Baker's news service, whowhatwhy.com. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order an audio CD or a film on DVD of Family of Secrets by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. Go to the website of Russ Baker's news service, WhoWhatWhy.com, for more forensic journalism stories and information on how to get involved. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD or DVD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio celebrates 20 years on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. Time of useful consciousness. Three of my most favorite words. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.